Friday afternoon, WCB Convention 2015.
Are the door prize people in here? No. All right. All right. They don't get the door prize. That's right. Well, I'm Denise Colley, and I am the facilitator for the first half of the afternoon session. And is Larry Albert in the room?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, good. All right. How many of you like old-time radio? How many of you listen to old-time radio? How many of you listen to... excuse me, I can't even talk today. How many of you listen to Imagination Theater? Okay, well, you heard a little bit about our next speaker at the awards luncheon, because he did get an award. And to talk to us this afternoon about old-time radio isn't just in the past. You're going to hear from a familiar voice. Larry Albert is an actor, writer, and director of the Jim French Productions and of the Imagination Theater. So please help me give a huge WCB welcome to Larry Albert.
Okay. Old-time radio. New-time radio. One of the things that I said in the awards banquet, and I'm still very grateful for that award, thank you so much, was that audio drama, which is what we call it now, full-cast audio drama, is the only medium outside of the storyteller from the old days where all you had to be able to do was listen and use your imagination. Because it is a form of art that is created for the mind. And the cliche, of course, is theater of the mind. Because you paint the picture. You design the costumes. You build the sets. You see how sexy the blonde is. Or how tall the 6'5" hero is with the deep voice. You are part of that creation. That's the only media where you are part of the creation. Without you, there's no point in doing it, all right? All you have to do is have an imagination. And one of the things that Jim and I have talked about is people who have been blind from birth, have never seen color, have never seen anything. What color is red to them? What color is blue? What does a castle look like in your mind? Well, the answer to that is anything you want it to be, right? Well, sometimes we give you a description, like we say, he was standing in front of me, 6'5", looking really angry. I didn't like his suit. It matched mine. Now, what color suit was I wearing? Okay, whatever you wanted. Old-time radio. I don't like using the term old-time radio because it is a media that is alive again today. With podcasts, there are hundreds and hundreds of young people out there today, young people, putting together full cast audio dramas. There's one producer I know who sends out his lines via the internet, email to the auditioners. They go in their closets so they can have a dead sound, record their lines, and send them in. They're not even in the same part of the country. Now, in the old days, a lot of it was done live. A lot of it was done in front of a live audience. Now, radio lasted, the golden age of radio, as we like to call it, and there are some variations on dates, lasted from the mid-30s until the late 40s, even though radio drama in this country kept going until 1960. But by 1960, it was a pale, pale imitation of itself. You had three shows that were on by 1960. And radio, network radio, as the old-time radio was called, went off the air September 30th, 1962, that was it. It was done, CBS. There have been attempts to bring it back, but they've all failed. The reason why we survive, God only knows. We couldn't tell you, but we've been on the air now. In March, it'll be 20 years, Imagination Theater. Now, I've been collecting old-time radio since 1972, so I've been at this now for 43 years, collecting old radio. Sadly, when I was asked to do this, I remembered that I've forgotten a lot. In all the years I've been reading the books and collecting, it's become so second nature to me, I've forgotten. And again, this is a little bit different presentation for me. A lot of the time, I bring visual aids. Thanks. I love you for that. Okay. So what I'm going to do is read an opening from a book called Don't Touch That Dial. It's written by J. Fred McDonald. It's subtitled Radio Programming in American Life from 1920 to 1960. And on chapter one, he basically says, somewhere between vaudeville and its traveling troupes and live stage shows and television with its audiovisual forms of amusement, America was in love with radio. It was not the news and music sameness of contemporary programming, which may be popular and lucrative, but is lacking in creative imagination. Instead, America was enamored of an entertainment medium which showcased everything from fine dramas, mundane soap operas, and sports action to formulaic detective stories, lavish comedy variety shows, and the latest developments in world news. Regardless of age, taste, wealth, or sex, there was much in broadcasting to please everyone. Daily, tens of millions of Americans were so pleased. And by the 1940s, almost every home in the nation was equipped with a radio set through which to hear and enjoy this programming. Radio was criticized. In the minds of many, radio was too banal, too concerned with the unspectacular vanities of commonness, and not involved enough with uplifting subjects like fine music and intellectual discussion. For others, it was too commercial. The advertisements that were sandwiched within and between programs not only interfered with the artistic aspects of the broadcasting, they also insulted the intelligence of the listeners. Moreover, it was alleged that stations and networks airing shows lost their integrity and independence when they sold themselves to the makers of laxatives, automobiles, shortening, and the like. I don't feel slighted by someone selling me a laxative. Thank you very much. Instead of being a great moral force, radio had become an audio peddler to which programs and content were less important than the commercial announcements. But as with today in television and cable and the inane ads we see, people still tune in, and they tuned in every day. There you go. Every form of television programming you see today, even the reality shows, Dancing with the Stars doesn't count, even where the reality shows started on radio, the situation comedy, the detective show, the thriller, the suspense, the ghost story, wicked witches, zombies and vampires were on radio before they showed up on television. And they were better looking on radio than they were on television. An actor with his voice could play many parts. I have played Dracula on the radio. I have come to you to say, I never drink wine. Or I played a guy talk like this, you know, y'all seen him. He down there. All right, I'd like an idea. How tall do you think I am? 6'3". 5'8". 5'9". 5'9". I'm 5'6". From my voice, how old do you think I am? 25. 45. I'm 66. But you only had my voice to go by. The most heroic cowboy on old-time radio, the Lone Ranger, Earl Grazer, who played him in the 30s and into the early 40s, was 5'8". Gene Autry was as tall as he ever wanted to be with those heels on the ends of his boots. But the Lone Ranger was played by an actor named Earl Grazer until he was killed in a car accident. He was 5'8". In order to please the audiences on personal appearances, they hired taller actors to put on the costume. And they didn't talk.
Because the Lone Ranger had to sound like this. I say, Tonto.
Tonto was a white guy from England who was in his 80s when he did the last broadcast. All right? Now, just for fun, I brought along a few clips of what old-time radio sounded like and what you might hear. Can we play the first clip, please?
The Jack Benny Program. Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, and yours truly, Don Wilson. And now we take you to Jack Benny's home in Beverly Hills. It's early morning. Jack is still asleep, and Rochester's in the kitchen preparing breakfast.
Hello, Mr. Benny's residence. Mr. Benny's residence, star of stage, screen, and radio. So whether you go out or stay home, he's got you trapped. Who? Oh, hello, Sam. I'm glad you called. Hurry right over and return that suit I rented you. The boss is back. I know your week ain't up yet, but I'll give you money pronto pro rato and providing I'm alive when you get here. That's right. And Sam, I wish you'd pass the word along to the rest of my clientele. Goodbye. Well, I guess I'm safe now. Uh-oh. I'll have to dig up some excuse about Mr. Benny's tuxedo. Doggone, when I rented it out for Jerome, how did I know they was going to cremate him? Oh, well, I'd better prepare breakfast before the boss gets up. Coming! Oh, it's you, Mr. Milkman.
Good morning, Rochester. I see by this note you left, you want me to start delivering milk again and stop leaving cream.
Yeah, Mr. Benny's back.
Oh, say, Rochester, is it true that Mr. Benny's going on the air for a new sponsor?
Yes, sir.
Well, look, you tell Mr. Benny I'll be listening to him. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Oh, by the way, there's a little matter of last month's bill. Here it is.
$28 for cream. Okay, I'll write you out a check for it.
Wait a minute. Is that a pair of dice you're taking out of your pocket?
Mr. Milkman, lay that bill down on the ground.
Oh, but Rochester, now look, I don't want...
It's too late now. I'm wound up.
Oh, all right.
Thank you, here David. Okay. Now, that was, as many of you know, the Jack Benny Show, which ran from 1932 to 1954. 22 years on the air. And that was a large complaint about old-time radio by the 40s. No new shows, no innovation, nothing was happening. Well, the 30s were the golden time for radio because all the discoveries were made. Jack Benny went on the air for General Tire. Now, Canada Dry. And he opened his very first radio show by saying, "Hello again, this is Jack Benny." There will be a silent pause where everybody says, "Who cares?" Little knowing he would become a household name. Radio in the early days, in the 20s, they wanted it to be a cultural event. They wanted nothing but fine music and educational talks. Burns and Allen didn't come along till the 30s. But they wanted it to be uplifting. They didn't want to commercialize it. Well, that got shot down when a local station in the Midwest bought time on the local station. Carpet dealer bought time on a local station, and he offered samples, big samples. And he thought he might get 4 or 5, 6, maybe 7 people. 2,000 people showed up to show how popular and powerful radio could be. Thus was born the nightmare of the advertising agency. And advertisements on all our radio. Do you realize today on television you actually get between 42 and 45 minutes of actual programming? Yes. 15 minutes of commercials. In the golden days of radio, in the early 30s, there was no time limit on commercials. They could run for 5 minutes. And some of them did. And then they would come back with the show, but by that time you didn't care anymore. They finally got a code going and said between 60 minutes. And, of course, the commercial usually appeared in the middle of the program. Now, Benny was very clever. He would work the commercial into the show. So the Sportsman Quartet would sing the commercial or something like that. Now, that's variety. Not everybody did that. And the variety show was born on radio, and it came right out of vaudeville. So many of your early radio stars back in those days were people who'd been huge vaudevillians or on Broadway. Eddie Cantor, Burns and Allen, Jack Benny, as we say. Fibber McGee and Molly were straight from small-time vaudeville. How many of you know who Fibber McGee and Molly are? Okay. Well, they came from small-time vaudeville, and they lasted until the late 50s in various formats. They used to dress up in costumes. In the old days in radio, when you see pictures, you see a lot of the variety show stars dressed up in costumes before the live audience. And then they got away from that. Now, for today, you watch a TV show, you have to do it by the sounds, or you have descriptive services on your television. So somebody's describing everything to you. In radio, the way they describe it in the old days and today, they don't insult your intelligence. Now, in the old days of radio, they did do some things. Now, picture this in your mind. You're a private detective. You're watching a house. Suddenly, you see the suspect drive up to the house, get out of the car, walk across the lawn, look through the window, walk around to the side of the house, silently open the side window, and crawl in. On television and in the movies and for sighted people, that's all silent. For the blind and the visually impaired, it's creepy. They would have... Thank you, I'll send you your check later. What they would do in radio was have two people watching the house. Say Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. And Watson would be saying, "Look, Holmes, he's driven up to the front of the house." "Yes, Watson, I know." "Look, Holmes, he's getting out of the car." "I can see that, Watson." "Look, Holmes, he's looking in the window. Now he's going around the side of the house. Good heavens, Holmes, he's raising the window. He's crawling through." "Yes, I know, Watson. Shut up." But the second character had to tell you what was going on. We try to avoid that in modern radio. We try to do it with sounds. And sometimes we succeed, and sometimes we get letters that say, "What was going on in that scene?" But in old radio, they pandered to the audience, although not as much as we think. If I was standing here and there's a lady on my right, Betty or Becky? Next to you, Melissa.
Becky Bell.
Becky's got pulled a gun on me. How would you know Becky's pulled a gun on me unless I told you on radio? And they had clever ways of saying it. "Well, Becky, I guess I'll have to do what you want me to because you've just pulled a gun on me." Okay, end of having to think about it. But, all right, Becky, are you serious? And you hear this, the cocking of a gun. There's no need for anybody to tell you she has a gun in her hand pointed at me. It's a Beretta, and it needs cleaning, Becky. One of the things in the golden age of radio, the age started during the Great American Depression. People couldn't afford to go out. Huge, hundreds of thousands of people out of work. Movies were doing anything to get people to come in. But that's when radio flourished, because you could get a cheap radio. You had to put an antenna up on your house, because it wasn't like it is today. And these were all tube, and it warmed up. And then you would search the dial. Every radio station worth its salt in the country had a dramatic group that worked with it, that did local drama shows that went on the radio. Sadly, almost none of these exist anymore in recordings. So you can't find local radio from the Golden Age. Almost none of it exists. Locally here, we found some transcription records for a cooking show that was done in Tacoma in the 1940s. Do not follow these recipes. By today's standards, you will die. All right? But that's it. Any radio station. In Seattle, you had Cairo. If you hear of a station with three letters in its name, KJR, that's one of the oldest stations in the country. Yeah. This goes... I'm sorry? KVI, the nightmare station. Jim French was on KVI for many, many years, and that's where he started doing new radio. That's where he started with the old Crisis series and Dameron in the 70s. And he moved to Cairo when he left KVI. They fire you on a Friday in radio. I might, you know, just a little trivia. After your shift, so they can get you out of the building before you can cause any problems. So they fire you after your shift. Let's hear another cut. Let's hear cut number two, David.
Ah, don't touch that dial. Listen to...
Blondie!
Yes, folks, that's another half hour of fun with Blondie and Dagwood.
Okay, that's enough of that. Now, what you're hearing are Armed Forces radio cuts. So all the commercials have been cut out, and they've padded it out with music that they've lifted from somewhere else. But Situation Comedy, Blondie, The Great Gildersleeve, River McGee and Molly, created on radio. So if you don't like what's on television today, blame them, because they started it. And most of it today doesn't hold up well, because if they're topical, you don't get the jokes. Okay? Now, one of the things, I'm talking a little longer than I got 20 minutes ago, but does anyone have any questions?
I do.
Okay.
Was the Honeymooners on
radio? No, the Honeymooners was strictly Jackie Gleason. It started on the Dumont Cavalcade of Stars, and then he did it briefly on his television variety show, and then for one season, he did 39 episodes, but it never was on the radio. There was a show called The Honeymooners on radio, but it was not the same thing. Anything? Anyone else?
I wanted to comment. I'm a big Stan Freberg fan.
Uh-huh.
And I love the way they have to talk on the mic. Okay, I don't know. We don't want this one. It's being recorded. Okay, sorry.
Oh, we don't have a portable mic, but you're a big fan of the Stan Freberg.
Well, anyway, I have these albums in my collection.
Uh-huh.
Volumes 1 and 2 are the best of his radio shows.
Uh-huh.
Should I start over again?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I am a big Stan Freberg fan, and I have two albums in my... I still collect vinyl, by the way. I have two albums in my collection.
Mm-hmm.
Volumes 1 and 2 are the best of Stan Freberg old-time radio shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoofed all these old radio shows. It was so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And he also hated commercials and... hated rock and roll, and he spoofed. He just spoofed everything. It was. I like that kind of thing, and I don't know if you've heard any of his stuff or not. But,
Stan Freberg.
Oh yes,
the Stan Freberg Show was the last network variety show on radio. It ran in 1957. They only did, I think, 17 episodes, and then it died. The lady in the back with the short hair, who's standing up.
Hi, Larry. It's Sue Amateur.
Oh, nice to meet you.
I got the pleasure of inviting Larry to come to this. But I was just going to mention, since you talked about Jim French,
mm-hmm.
When I was a little kid, about 5 years old, he was on King, which is now 1090, some weird sports station.
Right.
Anyway, but he was on with the Don McNeil Breakfast Club. So every morning when we sat and ate our breakfast before we went off to first grade, we listened to Jim French. So that shows how long he's been around and he's still working at doing radio, along with you, I know. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. Gentleman over in the wheelchair, your hand is up. You're wearing a black coat or something. Somebody, a sighted person, could you? There you go. Oh, by the way, I have never spoken before a group of visually impaired or blind, so if I make a PC mistake, please keep it to yourselves.
I'm just going to say one thing. I'm not a gentleman.
You're not?
No.
Oh, and this is good because I'm the sighted person.
I wouldn't know. Anyway, I have a question about... do they have some of the old Phil Harper episodes when Phil Harper played Harry Nile?
Oh, yeah, we have all of them.
I saw him live.
Mm-hmm.
And... I actually used to listen to him on Classic Country, and when he passed, that was just heart-wrenching.
It was. For those of you who don't know, Phil Harper played the role of Private Detective Harry Nile from 1976 until he passed away in October of 2004, and that's when I took over the role. He was quite a guy, and we had a lot of fun together, and he had a unique voice, which is one of the complaints that somebody wrote us the next day after I was announced as Harry Nile that said, Larry Albert's voice just doesn't do it for me. Melissa.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. Is this on?
Yeah. No, it's on.
You're good.
It's off or on, one of the two.
It's not on. It's on.
Okay, fine. Anyway, and thank you, Larry, again for coming and for doing this. But I'd love for you to tell all of us and those that are listening out there on ACB Radio, who are we're streaming right now all over the world, but what is the difference between doing radio acting as opposed to stage acting? Because we obviously know you do both. So could you just tell us the difference and or similarities?
Stage acting. You're on a, depending on what theater you're in, if you're in a full theater like the Village, which is classically designed, your gestures have to be a little bit bigger so the people in the back can see what you're doing. You don't, now with everybody being mic'd, you don't have to project quite so far with your stage voice, but it doesn't allow intimacy of acting. Now, in film and television, because the camera's right on top of you, I can go up to someone and say, you've got a red shirt on. I want it. Give it to me. Now. But on stage, if I did that, you'd hear, what? What did he say? Radio acting is much like film acting. It's very intimate. The mic is right there. You don't have to be huge. You can play a love scene up close. You can play, and generally the person you're playing the love scene with is about 20 feet on the other side of the room on a different microphone, which makes for interesting pillow talk. But that's the basic difference. And you can't lie to a camera, you can't lie to a microphone. A microphone will tell if you can act or not, or if you mean what you're saying or not. The basic rule, acting 101, is listen. Listen to what the other person is saying and talk to them, not at them. So when you talk to someone, all right? Sir, in the shirt with the beard and the thing in the... I can't see you, and I'm not going for sex. I just screwed that up, really.
I am a male. anyways, was Stan... Oh, hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Was Stan Borison ever on the radio?
You know, I've had the chance to work with Stan.
Yeah?
And he's a great guy, and I grew up watching him. I grew up in the Seattle-Tacoma-Everett area. Yeah. I know nothing about his career beyond the clubhouse, so I can't answer. Jim French would know. They're great friends, but I can't honestly answer that. I think he had a day show on King, maybe.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
It was a kids' clubhouse or King's
clubhouse. Well, it was King's clubhouse. Yeah.
And, on TV. And also, the last I heard, he was in a nursing home in Shoreline.
That I can't tell. I can't address.
Okay.
I will tell this story on Stan. How many of you grew up in the Seattle-Tacoma area? Yeah, okay. If you were around in the 50s and early 60s, they had kid shows, what they called the uncle shows, you know, or the Brakeman Bill or Wanda Wanda in this area. And Stan had a show where he had a beagle. It's a dog. It's a dog. What are you talking here? It's a dog already. And named Nomo. So Jim wrote a show that incorporated Stan into the show called No More Nomo Matter. And we would do these shows once a month live at the Seattle Museum of History and Industry. And Stan said, yes, I'll be there. I'd love it. He walks in and all the kids, older people who grew up there, Stan Borison, and we started to rehearse. And Jim turned to me very quietly and said, he can't act. Because everything Stan did was improvised on television. He never had a script. And we were going to do this in front of a live audience, and he can't act. And Jim was horrified. And he couldn't go up to his friend Stan and say, "You suck." You know. So we got through it. Jim's wife, Pat French, worked diligently with Stan in between the rehearsals and the live session. We have only aired that show once. Never again. So that's local history. Anybody else with a question before I move on? Yes, sir. There you go, buddy. You're going to be in shape by the time we finish this.
Probably something you were going to answer anyway, but what's the best way to listen to Imagination Theater on a mobile device or online? It used to be syndicated pretty broadly over the air and had a hard time finding it the last few years. So.
Well, it's on KIXI and 880 on the AM dial. AM, 880 AM, and it's on 8 o'clock Saturday, Sunday, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Now, if you are from out of town, I'm not sure what station, but we do air the show on our website called harrynile.com. And you can listen to the show on your device through our YouTube channel. We have a link right there on the homepage of the website. We run 3 weeks' worth of the show, and you can hear the entire show with commercials. Sorry. Yeah. And on harrynile.com. All right?
And it's very accessible for a screen reader user.
Yes. At any device that can stream or pick up YouTube, you can get the show on. And speaking of that, old-time radio. There are literally hundreds of websites out there that play free old-time radio. If you have a show you remembered or you heard your parents talk about, it's there for you to listen to. Radio in this country was killed and died when television kicked in. And I used to teach a class at Highland Community College for seniors about old-time radio. And one question they asked me was, what killed old-time radio? And I would say, well, the advertisers moved to TV. But the biggest murderer of old-time radio was the audience. Because you guys left. You went to television. And when you came back or remembered about radio, it had changed. So the audience left it and went to television. But the audience, people who didn't grow up, I didn't grow up during the Golden Age. I was born in 1949. By the time I discovered radio, it was rock and roll and Elvis Presley, all right? I got hooked into old-time radio, oddly enough, in Vietnam, where I was at during the war, and Armed Forces Radio played it, and it was a whole new thing for me. And when I came back, I discovered it and how to get it, and that became my hobby, and it's been my main hobby for years. But it gave you everything. It gave you everything. The theater of the mind. This is, as I say, I cannot stress this enough. Blind, visually impaired, this was your media. This was your media. How did it die? Partly, as I've said, but partly because it stagnated. There was no competition. A friend of mine and I were talking this morning. Most of the Emmys this year were won by cable stations. ABC, NBC, CBS, I think they won one or two between them, I'm not sure. Because now you can go in and on television and you can get hundreds of TV stations all around, depending on your cable outfit. The competition is fierce. In the days of radio, that was it. ABC, NBC, CBS, and Mutual. And ABC didn't come along until 1944. Okay? There was no other competition on a national level. So it didn't grow. It shows that lasted for decades. Lux Radio Theater. Lux lasted from 1934 to 1954. Or 55. But it was still doing adaptations of movies. Suspense lasted 20 years doing various things with short stories, and they'd get guest stars in. But 20 years of an anthology. On television, a show like that might last a season. But there was no competition, so radio stagnated. In the 50s, when television came in, radio started to think, we got to change things. The best example of this, Gunsmoke. Gunsmoke started on radio in 1952. I've been lucky enough to work with and know some of the people who were on that show. It lasted until 1961. None of the people who were on the radio show were ever auditioned for the TV show. And there's a reason for that, but I don't want to go into that. But it was, if you took me 15 steps to walk from here to the back of this room and up onto the sidewalk, then to go back to the marshal's office, it down the sidewalk, took me 15 steps to get back. And they would take the time to do it. The gunshots you heard on Gunsmoke were real gunshots. They went out and recorded all kinds of weaponry. It's a wonder these guys weren't arrested for having an arsenal. The horse sound. Everything on Gunsmoke was better than, as far as technical quality, was better than most old-time radio because they had the luxury. Nobody was looking over their shoulder. But at the same time, nobody was listening. So now that we've got Imagination Theater going and we have audience, we don't count our audience in the millions now like they used to. We count our audience in the hundreds nationwide. And we're happy to have you. What's the third cut, David? Yeah, go ahead and play it.
Performance USA, the greatest entertainers in America, as requested by you, the fighting men of the United States Armed Forces throughout the world.
Command Performance!
Presented this week and every week till it's over, over there.
Thank you, David. Command Performance, how many of you know about it? Mail Call, how many of you know about it? Jubilee USA. Okay. You know why you don't know about it, most of you? You never heard it, because it was never broadcast in this country. During World War II, the Armed Forces Committees in Hollywood and New York got all the major talent to donate their time on a weekly basis to come in and do these half-hour to 45-minute shows that were only heard by the guys fighting in World War II. And sent out on discs, these guys. They were never broadcast over the air. Armed Forces Radio, I cannot say enough about them. They inadvertently, I can't think of the word I want, archived or saved hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of old-time radio shows because nothing was really saved back then. Of all the thousands of shows broadcast between 1934 and 1949, 70% of them don't exist. Because they were throwaway. Nobody thought it would be of any value. Most of what exists are the Armed Forces Radio discs. So for you collectors, unfortunately, Armed Forces Radio doesn't exist anymore. Because now you've got the internet. But when I was in Vietnam, we got Armed Forces Radio and television. And that's how we discovered old-time radio. So for the lovers of old-time radio, that's your big one. Now, I could go on, and I probably will for another 3 minutes because my time is running short. About old-time radio. But I don't like to call it old-time radio, guys, because you didn't hear it coming out. You didn't hear it. Now, it's all new. So it's old-time, new-time radio, just like what we do. There are long runs of shows that do exist. There was a show on the air called The Crime Doctor. 9 years that was on the air, 9 years on network radio. 8 episodes exist. And there's a reason. It was a lousy show. But you have the Lux Radio Theater. They broadcast 600 and some shows. 400 and some of them exist. They're out there if you want to find it. All of our shows exist. We have a library of over 800 scripted shows produced by Imagination Theater and Jim French. Our goal is to entertain you, not to educate you. Our goal is to do what they did in the golden age of radio, and that is to give you a half an hour away from your troubles and any pain and sadness, and maybe get a laugh or two out of you. My favorite line in A Harry Nile, when I took over the role, inadvertently, and a cop played by Terry Rose, who's wonderful, said something to me, and I said, "You do know the war is over. They can get parts for your brain now." Okay? Great insult. Yeah, thank you. Great insult, and I have used that on many people since then. All right. What's the last cut on there, David? Yes. This was Inner Sanctum Mysteries. Inner Sanctum was the campiest, scariest show on radio, except for The Witch's Tale. Or The Hermit's Cave. The Hermit's Cave I always loved because weird stories, ghost stories, stories to make you do bad things in your bed. Let's play the Inner Sanctum cut, David. That's a door opening.
Good evening, friends of the creaking door. This is your host to welcome you into the Inner Sanctum for another visit with your favorite characters. We're back again with a familiar subject, murder. Ever want to find out how scared you can get? Well, suppose you hang around for a while, and when the show's over, I'll cut you down.
Thank you, David. I love being a part of audio drama. I love playing all the roles I get to play. In 41 years as a professional actor, I never enjoy myself more than in the room with John Patrick Lowry, who's our Sherlock Holmes, and I get to play Dr. Watson opposite. Pat French, when she was still working. Being Harry Nile, being Inspector McKenzie, it looks like this. He's a great scoot. I love doing him. But I get to fantasize and about all these characters and play them. There is nothing on radio I can't be except a girl. And we tried. But really, I'd like you to go away from this thinking, having new thoughts about audio drama. It specifically, if nothing else, is designed for the imagination. And you've all got one. You've all got the time. There's nothing about audio drama that prohibits you from enjoying it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Larry, so much. Wasn't that awesome? Okay, if the members of our next panel could be making their way up here. Are the door prize people ready? You know these door prize people. Yes, I do. Thank you, Danette. I do have an announcement we were asked to make. For those of you planning to be at the Guide Dog Users of Washington State dinner, it will be in the Aberdeen Room at 5 p.m. You're welcome. the Aberdeen room. I didn't even know. On the third floor? Didn't even know there was such a room. Second floor. All right, let me. You know, this microphone has a mind of its own. All right. I feel really honored to get to introduce this next panel because we have with us three individuals who, in one way or the other, I've had the privilege to work with. And probably know more about services to the blind than just about anybody in this state. So the topic of our next presentation is exploring services to the blind then, now, and in the future. I'm going to introduce the panel, and then each one of them will have an opportunity to speak. And if time permits, we'll do questions at the end. I know that's going to tax some of us to try to remember what our question even was, because that's what happens when you get to be my age. But I think you can do it. So our panelists this afternoon are Deb Lewis. Debbie is currently a consultant with the Washington State Department of Services for the Blind. And that's only one of many hats that Deb wears, but probably is very knowledgeable. Secondly, a gentleman who I haven't seen in a while, but Washington will always claim him. I got to serve with him when I was on the State Rehab Council, and it was an absolute joy. Dan Fry is the executive director of the New Jersey Commission for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And our third speaker was actually, I first started working with him when I went to work for Department of Services for the Blind back in 1985. Our third panelist is Paul Jajic. Paul is a former director of the Washington State Department of Services for the Blind and just was just a wonderful person to work with. So please help me welcome the panel, and Deb will be our first presenter.
Thank you. Come down at me. Oh, there, that's perfect. Well, you know, I have been employed by the state of Washington and in some way connected employment-wise with the Department of Services for the Blind, actually, since 1974. So that's a long time. I'm really old. And I always tell people I started when I was 12. But then I thought about when did I actually meet the Department of Services for the Blind, and that was in 1970 when I attended the Northwest Rehabilitation Center for the Blind, which is now what we call the OTC. And I was trying to capture, just for a little perspective of the then and now, what it's like at DSB. And I wanted to capture some of what it was like in 1970. And I was having a hard time with that until I discovered an email that someone had forwarded to me a while back, actually a couple years ago, which was an email written by the illustrious John Olson. Many of you know John. John was an O&M instructor for 2,327 years at the Department of Services for the Blind. John was a parapetologist, as some of us will recall. And so anyway, basically, John wrote a little memoir in 2006 about what DSB was like in 1970. And somebody found that and sent that to me a couple years ago, and I stashed it in my email. And I edited it significantly to fit the time we have, and also because it had lots of details like room numbers and stuff But if any of you actually want the whole thing, it's quite an entertaining read. And you're welcome to email me, deb@lewissound.net, and I'd be glad to send it to you, because it is an entertaining read if you go back, or even if you don't, it's entertaining. But I'm going to read what I think are the highlights of it. So, according to John, the Seattle office building was paid for by some special federal funding earmarked for hospitals and rehabilitation facilities. Our lobby used to have a plaque designating this building as the Northwest Regional Rehabilitation Center for the Blind. Early on, we did, in fact, serve people from all RSA Region 10 states, Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. Oregon and Idaho soon developed their own rehabilitation centers, followed by Alaska in the 1980s. In the mid-1980s, the name of the rehabilitation center was changed to Orientation and Training Center. The Northwest Rehabilitation Center for the Blind was organized along the lines of some of the other few existing rehabilitation centers for the blind in the country at the time. In particular, we were largely modeled after the first Veterans Administration's Rehabilitation Center for the Blind, located in Hines, Illinois. This was a large hospital for injured veterans. Hence, we were initially organized along a medical model of rehabilitation that stressed physical rehabilitation along with sensory rehabilitation and psychological adjustment experienced by traumatized veterans. Our rehabilitation center staff of 1970 consisted of a director, a psychiatrist, a social worker, a home economics instructor — that was Letha, by the way, for those of you who remember. Yeah, I thought you would. A braille and typing instructor — that was Alice Olson, if you remember back that far. Two orientation and mobility specialists — those were John Olson and Mark Monkey, for those who are historians. And a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, a shop instructor — that was Andy — and several consultants. The consultants we had were two psychiatrists, two psychologists, and an ophthalmologist, a music therapist, and a fashion makeup specialist. Yeah. Until the mid-1980s, the Seattle office was the state headquarters office and home of the director, assistant director, business office, and the BEP program. So some of those aren't all there now. Nevertheless, in 1970, the OTC used to occupy much of the first and second floors of the Seattle office. In those days, there were two O&M instructors, like I said, John Olson and Mark Monkey, also located in the very same office space where the braille instructor, Alice Olson, and the OTC secretary, Trudy Munson, and the three part-time consultants, the physical therapist, the music therapist, and a fashion makeup specialist. Yeah, we like that one. The home economics room was located upstairs in the current staff lounge and some counselor offices. Those counselor offices were taken over from the bedroom that was part of that full apartment that was there, with the living room, kitchen, bedroom, and bath. And definitely quite a whole scale apartment in there. The Rehabilitation Center director was Rod Kosick. Boy, that goes back. Oh. The therapeutic social worker was Ruth Meals. Yeah, oh yeah. There was an agency library along with two soundproof rooms. There was a chapel. You could still notice the soundproofing still on the walls. There was a first aid and medical exam room with a half bath. And there was a low vision room in a very small office. And there were student study rooms, two of those. And the men's and women's restrooms had an adjoining shower and student locker room in each. Well, the physical therapy and exercise room, hence the need for those showers and lockers, was a large room near the restroom. So you actually needed all these showers and things. The music and fashion makeup classroom was also another large room on that second floor. The business office and the agency safe — remember, the Seattle office was also the state headquarters for DSB in 1970, was also located upstairs. The agency director was Jerry Dunham. The assistant director was Ike Meyer. The chief of rehabilitation services was Don Crawford. We're all located upstairs in the Seattle office. There was a bullpen with the enclave of all the VR counselors, Dave Hungerford, Lloyd Smart, Mary Beth Williams, and he says she's not a bull, and Russ Mackey in the Seattle office, and their secretaries. It was a little sea of desks. Cubicle walls had not yet been invented. The shop was a large room downstairs. The shop instructor was Garfield Andy Anderson. And there was also a small engine and lawnmower repair and mechanical aptitude testing room located downstairs. It should be explained that in those days, DSB had recently split from Handcrest and Skillcraft, which were the sheltered workshop entries affiliation that became the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind. The shop instructor, Andy Anderson, and the agency's assistant director, Ike Meyer, came to the department from that split. Both had strong skills in manual arts, and for a short time anyway, many of the jobs being developed for people who are blind were manual in nature. So this room, especially the mechanical aptitude testing portion, was somewhat busy. In the late 1970s, this room was equipped with two audiological type soundproof booths for audio recording materials, and the room became used for audio programmed learning later on. So for the occupational therapy room was another large room located downstairs, and Carolyn Card was the occupational therapist at that time. The loading platform was then outside and at the very west end of what is now the garage and snack machine room. The garage and snack machine room did not exist in 1970, and the driveway was much steeper. The women's lounge was located in the room where the accessible bathroom is now located, and men had the loading platform to hang out on. A few final notes about the Seattle office building of 1970. We did not lock entrances, doors, during business hours. Occasionally, one would enter and exit via one of the doors with a purse that did not belong to them, but it was years until we finally decided to lock doors during business hours. The outside waiting room did not exist. That was the reception area. In the late 1970s, we sold food stamps out the counter in the business office. Somebody decided to fire a pistol that went through the wall under the counter, bounced off the floor, and lodged in the ceiling. And now to the eventual end of food stamp sales and securing of the reception area. We had an outside overhead cover off the parking lot that ran from the smokestack to the back door, a nice thing in stormy weather, but perhaps a hazard if we get a big earthquake, an eventual possibility since we know that that there's a fault running under South Alaska Street. And, of course, many of you know that later DSB had a lot of remodeling done because of that. He said that the driveway has been actually, the pavement there has been replaced three times since 1970 and was cracking again, and guess what, it is again. We had no accessible restrooms, but we did have more of them. We had people and lots of them, staff, visitors, and clients who smoked at their desks as well as in the restrooms, meeting rooms, cafeteria, and the offices of non-smokers. That practice was not good for anybody in the building, says John. We had beautiful lawns and gardens that were maintained weekly by a gardening service. We had glass windows that were cleaned a couple of times a year, but being glass, we sometimes had to have them replaced due to BB guns or thrown rocks. We had electric IBM typewriters that were used by the business office and secretaries in the vocational rehabilitation and the BEP programs. The secretaries largely worked from dictation records by VR counselors and agency administrators. At a computer was the truck-sized, a computer was a truck-sized thing that companies like IBM and Honeywell were developing, and with no vision that everybody at DSB would one day have one on their desks. There were no copy machines. We had a one-page copier and high-copy photocopiers just did not exist in those particular days. We maintained case files via a running record where you just typed new entries next to the old ones, and he comments that there was no such thing as any security of case files. We had locking file cabinets, but case files very rarely made it into them. They were usually seen on counselors' desks. But in those days, ID theft wasn't a worry. John closes by saying, we had few phones in the building, he also said, and there were a few in the business office, and counselors shared a phone with their secretary. Let's face it, everybody had to call long distance to call the agency, and there was no toll-free number, so it was okay. He comments that the janitor unlocked the door every morning at 7:45 and locked it every evening at 5, and how dare you ever go in before or after he allowed you. They had a wonderful cafeteria on the bottom floor, and people had hot lunches and breaks, and the students and staff all ate there together. We had some good staff then, and we still do. We do good work then, and we still do. We did things a bit differently then, and we still do. And I guess that's really how it goes, and I love being part of Services for the Blind, and I thought it was fun to take us back to when I came as a high school student.
That brings back memories. Dan Fry.
No worries. Good afternoon, everyone. It is a real pleasure and delight to find myself back in Washington State and in the company of many of you who I've had occasion to know throughout the course of my life. I want to just say that it really truly does feel like returning home. And inevitably, when you decide to acknowledge a few folks, you inadvertently leave someone out. But I'd like to acknowledge a few of my heroes in this organization before I turn to my topic at hand. Certainly, Denise Colley and I worked hand-in-hand together on the State Rehabilitation Council in the early 2000s, and as she says, that always was a pleasure. Sue Amater has been a long and trusted friend of mine, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to come back at her invitation. I have known Carl and Kathy Jarvis for many years, both personally and professionally, and you are lucky to have the people of their talent in your midst. I listen to Deb Lewis on the radio still now and remember her from when I worked in Washington before. Alco Canfield has been a long friend of mine, and Julie Brannon, we've known one another off and on throughout the years. But the Washington Council of the Blind is an organization large and vibrant and full of people whose acquaintance I've not had occasion to meet. And I've been tasked today with talking to you about the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, the newest manifestation of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 as amended. The Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act was signed by President Obama last July 2014. And Title IV of the Act, which is our portion of the Act, the Rehab Act, went into effect immediately, where the other three titles of the act didn't go into effect until July of this year. I don't want, as is sometimes the inclination of a trained lawyer, to go into a lot of boring detail about the law. And so what I've decided to do is outline six or seven very important changes to WIOA that I think you should be aware of, because I think they will have some impact on the services that you may receive. Obviously, I want to also, prior to embarking on this quick description, to acknowledge Luoma Durand and the professional staff at DSB who have the obligation of trying to figure out this new approach to rehabilitation. So absolutely feel pleased to know that they will work hard with you to address rehab via WIOA. Major changes of consequence in WIOA. Number one, Congress decided to try and give significant attention to the needs of those who are in transition age. Not an inherently objectionable concept. However, when the language was actually adopted, it was adopted in a way that was much more narrowly defined than most advocates across the political spectrum imagined it would be. WIOA requires that pre-employment transition services be provided to students who are everything up until you graduate from high school, and it requires that 15% of your federal appropriation under the Rehab Act be devoted to pre-employment transition services. Problems with this particular piece of legislation include the fact that there remains some uncertainty about the definition of what pre-employment transition services will be. Why is this? It is because the Rehabilitation Services Administration is currently in the midst of evaluating, digesting, and responding to the comments that over 4,000 people submitted in June. And the regulations that are slated to come out and be final are not expected until the spring. I was here in Seattle this week at the meetings of CSAVR, the Council of State Administrators of Vocational Rehabilitation, and the National Council of State Agencies for the Blind. And the folks at RSA said that March, in their mind, is late winter, and spring was elusive. But the real challenge is that if the definition of pre-employment transition services is not loosened up, there is some potential, if administrators are not innovative, that resources that might have been dedicated to adult rehabilitation could be transitioned to those in transition. Second, another major change in WIOA. WIOA requires that core partnerships exist among all entities across the federal government that are committed to trying to promote employment. Rehabilitation, of course, is that aspect of the federal public policy program that promotes employment for persons with disabilities. But the other core partners have to do with literacy, youth, and other miscellaneous areas. And while there may be some advantages to working together with new partners to submit what is either going to be known as a unified or combined state plan, it is now mandatory that these plans be submitted together, and not just stapled together, but in fact as a document that strategically anticipates how VR will work with literacy and youth and everything else. The challenge with that is that many of the core partners in the employment spectrum simply do not know and do not have an interest in knowing about disability. A third major change of consequence under WIOA. There are new performance and accountability measures that transcend all of the core partners and to which all of the core partners will be subject. The obvious and inherent challenge in this is that the four programs that WIOA includes are dramatically different. It seems to me that it's going to be hard, if not impossible, to have four programs that have distinctly different missions measured with the same measures. Additionally, one of the measures, which is to identify the effectiveness of how we engage with employers, is a measure that has not yet even been determined. Congress has allowed the Rehabilitation Services Administration to decide how to define that measure. Other measures that may be of interest to you are the fact that instead of being measured as a successful closure after 90 days of having your job, the rehabilitation agency is going to need to know what successful candidates are doing 6 months and 1 year post-VR, something that doesn't sound like it would be incredibly difficult, except that VR generally has not made it a practice to be big brother and to follow you to such an extended period of time after you leave. So many of the measures that will be applied across the board could be complications. A fourth change. Section 511 of the Act is a piece of the legislation that requires that most young people be directed to integrated competitive employment settings. That is a piece of the legislation that is, I think, generally agreeable to most folks. There are provisions, however, for letting people work in settings that are more segregated after considerable effort has been made to make sure that an inclusive, integrated setting can be achieved. There are, however, ambiguities in what that means. A fifth change. WIOA strongly focuses not only on the interests of delivering rehabilitation services to disabled consumers, blind people like you and I, but it also focuses now on serving employers. And the language in the Act characterizes employers as customers. Now, I think there is some inherent advantage in engaging with employers with the goal of helping those employers welcome blind and vision impaired people into their operations. But I worry a little bit that Congress, in its zeal to cater to business, has given a little much weight to employers when it decides to characterize them as equal to the consumers that VR should be serving. A sixth change, and I'm nearing the end of my list and then only have a few other comments. WIOA requires significant attention be paid to a concept which has been in practice for more than 40 years, but has now a new professional name, and that is customized employment. Customized employment actually is an approach to VR that is appropriate for people who generally require some level of supported employment, and some of the elements inherent in customized employment are, in fact, very customer-centric. A long discovery process where the counselor tries to engage with the consumer to find out genuinely what he or she might want to achieve. But customized employment and the obligations under supported employment have now been expanded. That expansion may have some impact on conventional VR services. And finally, the seventh change in WIOA that I noted that thought might be significant, and apparently so does Congress, even after the law has been adopted, is that WIOA requires VR agencies to engage with their core partners in strategic planning about how they will operate together. Senator Patty Murray has wondered if that is being effectively done already and has launched a General Accounting Office inquiry to find out whether or not VR agencies are finding that the requirements for developing strategic plans are working well. These are some of the major changes. And I want to take now just a moment to comment on both the opportunities and challenges that WIOA promises. There are opportunities, and I don't want to be perceived as entirely pessimistic. One opportunity is that while these new partners do not know us well as persons with disabilities, it may be that we can access some of their resources, that we can do some education, and that we can leverage some of their support. But the other opportunity is that we can do some education of them so that VR becomes a better marketed and understood commodity. Challenges, however, are, I think, more important to consider right now. Not because, again, I want to be pessimistic, but because I want to make sure that the implementation of WIOA does nothing to disadvantage our community. Challenges include risks to VR in terms of being recognized by the federal government if we have to be part of a unified or combined state plan. If those who are organizing the state plan don't understand VR, or if VR is not permitted to have a sufficiently strong place at the table, our voice could be smaller in the submitted state plan. Second challenge. An obligation to educate those who don't know about disabled people. A third challenge, risks associated with other labor-oriented entities like unemployment or other labor entities that are part of the partnership seeking VR resources. It's called cost sharing, and it's a euphemism for give us your money. A fourth challenge, defining and understanding what PETS and what the exact terms of the 15% reservation will be. Another challenge, uncertainty about the new accountability measures and how they will be effectively applied to our community. And finally, challenges related to questions about how to expand supported employment without compromising the delivery of services into all of the full array of those we have to serve. Inevitably, this bill was over 900 pages in length. It tried to bring together rationally all programs dealing with employment. But I think it tried to do it in a way that was too all-consuming and presumed the existence of partnerships that have historically not wanted to work. But I leave you not blue, but hopeful and optimistic that with good leadership in state agencies around the country, assertive advocacy groups such as your own, and competent and reasonable people willing to listen to what we have to say as our partners in the WIOA system, that VR can remain as strong and meaningful and transformative as it always has been. But it will be incumbent upon us to make sure that such is the case. WIOA is not a panacea, but it is not the end of the world. We have our work cut out for us, but I'm optimistic that being motivated to keep VR in existence, we'll undertake that work, we'll take Congress's offerings, and we'll make more of them than they ever imagined we could. Thank you.
And finally, Paul Jajic.
It's great to be back. Some of you are familiar faces, and I may be a familiar voice to some, but it's been a few years. I was director of the Commission for the Blind, from about 1982 for a year, and then it became the Department of Services for the Blind during a very turbulent and formative time for the agency. And I've been given, actually I asked for, my slice of this for just a couple of minutes is to focus on the blind agency, blind consumer community, blind community relationship in the past and in the future, and really what works and what doesn't. We heard Deb give a fabulous pictorial view, the travelscape from upstairs to downstairs and what it was like in that building then. And we heard Dan talk about the future that's unfolding on us. And I think there is something that weaves throughout that, which is the agency that's there for the blind community and the blind community's relationship with it. And in this state, that relationship has been about as important for the quality of services and for opportunities for people who are blind and vision impaired as anything. I love John's point, Deb, that there were good people then, there are good people now, and I see some of those good people here from many years ago and who work there now. But in terms of the quality of opportunity, And he said things were done differently now and they're then and they're done differently now. Well, some of those things are really different. I think there's what's happened in the last two decades has been an amazing ability to demonstrate support for employment, vocational jobs that 20 years ago we didn't do very well. We didn't do as well. There was a lot of focus on, as we heard, helping with adjustment to trauma, and actually homemaker closures was a successful closure. That was the typical closure. And now, Luoma, how many placements last year?
We had 169
competitive employment closures last year. How many staff do you have?
About 80.
About 80? In 1982, those of you who were there, I think we had about 65 or 70. Is that right? Carl, do you recall? About the same number?
Yeah.
No, staff. About the same number of staff?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there was a big cut. But we were in the 70 or so range, I think, when I, 60, 70. And one of our stretch goals the first year we were there was 55 placements. Stay alive at 55. That's exactly right. We did include the homemakers, but most of those were competitive employment. And Luoma was there as well as a rehab teacher. Pat Diamond was a new staff person on, and he got 12 closures out of the 55. And everybody said, who is this new young guy? So things have changed. And what's available for folks who come to the agency is different and better. But I want to give a few reflections on the then and now for the blind agency and the consumer community relationship. How many of you were in Olympia, came down on the bus at 8 o'clock in the morning a couple years ago for the hearing? Can I see a show of hands or clap? Can I see? Okay. I was watching on TVW and actually emailing from my home. Actually, I received an email. I wasn't sure to say emailing.
I received an email from the Republican ranking member of that committee halfway through it. I had emailed members of the committee that I knew with my thoughts about the bill. That bill, by the way, for those who weren't there, was a bill to put the programs of the department back into the Department of Social Health Services. Remember that bill?
Yeah.
Okay. And I want to, of the what works and what doesn't work, that worked that morning. The hearing started off with the Secretary of DSHS coming up to testify about a different bill, which was to divide the Department of Social Services into four different units because it was too big to manage. And she was trying to explain that that was not what was needed, et cetera. And the legislative questions and early attacks, I can't remember if there was testimony, but there may have been some, was all about how in the world are you going to shape up DSHS? Mm-hmm. That bill was heard. Thanks very much. Next bill, proposal from the governor to put the programs of the Department of Services for the Blind under DSHS. There were 30 minutes left, because I think there were a couple other bills, and the chair looked out at, I think it was close to 45 people. It was well over, right? 45 people who had come down to testify, most leaving Seattle or other environs to hit an 8 o'clock hearing that was called on about a week's notice or less. Remember the bus? Renting the bus? And he said, you can have 1 minute. Each person can have 1 minute to testify. And the testimony started. And they were one-minute vignettes of testimonials about the relationship that that person had with the department. There were some that talked about the services and the difference they made in their life, but a very clear theme was about the feeling that this agency listened, we could work with this agency, we've made changes with this agency is something we feel connected to. In the middle of that, I got an email from the Republican vice chair that said, this bill is going no place. And it was pretty clear why. In fact, the irony of the two, the testimonies, was amazing. That's what works. When we are standing shoulder to shoulder to the outside world that gives us our authorizing environment, gives us the funding, we can accomplish things. Let me tell you what doesn't work. Another vignette, legislatively. I had just been hired as director, and I was doing a few legislative visits, and I had two legislators use exactly the same phrase. Keep those blind people away from me. And what they were talking about was, we were just had come out of, and for those of you who remember those times, a very contentious time of controversy between the blind community and the agency, between within the blind community, and that had spilled over to the legislature, and legislators would hear from some folks and say, well, gee, my gosh, I'm going to try to do something about that, and they start doing about it, and all they'd do is get turned around, they'd be sideswiped by somebody else in the blind community, and they kind of talked to the agency, and all they learned was, I'm going to throw my hands up. Hmm. So they told, yeah, I'm the director of the agency, and I'm going to keep the blind agency away from you. Yeah, right. Yeah. You know? That's what doesn't work. So how that happens, how that transition happens, to me it comes down to two roles between the people who are served, who actually the agency is accountable to, and the agency, that on one level we perceive as having the power, if you will, but in reality it's a power that's shared. And that role is, I like to typify as, face-to-face and shoulder-to-shoulder. I loved the previous panel of previous speakers' comment about in radio, yes, the thing is you need to listen, yes, and you need to talk to each other, not at each other. Fabulous. That's exactly it. Face-to-face means you're sitting literally and talking together about what's going to make the agency and the programs as good as they can be. There are realities about it. There are limitations. There are things that have to be taken into account. That means we don't talk about it. That means hopefully we look honestly at those and see what they are and where we need to grow, but also what are our real choices. And together we're committed to doing that and making those improvements and choices that'll keep us moving forward. And my God, the agency has moved forward for 20 years. Probably beyond that, if you will, but that's my perspective, the trajectory I've watching and seeing the fabulous work that the different directors who followed me did, the fabulous leadership Laurel was given in 1982. She was a rehab teacher in Vancouver and now the longest serving director. And for each of you, Doug, Carl, who else has worked for the agency over the years? I'm going to forget names. Alco. Boy, what a job you've done. And the folks who are there now. Making that transition from a commission, Frank Kuda, I see in the background, who was instrumental. Frank, you were around during these years. It was a commission that hired me. And then the transition we went to stay independent was turned into an agency the governor, the governor appoints a director. The blind community appeared to be losing its power, right? What we negotiated was a very strong advisory committee. That was 1982, 1983. I forget when the state rehab council legislation passed. 92, 10 years later. That legislation for state rehab councils, it has some different wording and some specific responsibilities. But a couple years ago, I had the chance to come in and talk with the DSBA State Rehab Council, and I went back and looked at the advisory committee statutory responsibilities and an SRC responsibility under federal law. And there are actually things in the state statute that are stronger. There are some powers and responsibilities given by the state legislature, like advising the legislature on things, that is not explicit in the federal law. We wrote in together a role for the blind community to the State Rehab Council as a partner to do that face-to-face, sit down together, and keep the program improving. The second role I mentioned is the shoulder-to-shoulder. So when needed, we turn out and we march shoulder to shoulder. Because the role that the agency can play and LOMA can play inside state government is consequential. It has its opportunities and it has its real limitations. When the governor says that's not going to be in the budget, or the governor says I'm going to put a bill in to put the agency back under DSHS, LOMA has a limitation on what impact she can have. She still needs to be your partner. And she was, and you were. And I'm not going to go into any detail about that, but just let me say there were all kinds of conversations that happened, and Fred Schroeder, former RSA commissioner, was very helpful with a number of you in leadership, keeping in touch about that. There was communication about the shoulder-to-shoulder relationship that led to, on that morning, that hearing, the blind community coming and saying, we're partners with this agency, leave it alone. It works. That's what works. I think I'd like to leave it with that.
Thank you to all three panelists. I think this was very thought-provoking, and it was nice to kind of go back in history and see where we were then and where we are now and where we're going in the future. Please help me give another round of applause for our panel. And I'm pleased to have had the opportunity to facilitate this segment of the program, and we will now take a 15-minute break.
Denise?
Yes. Do you have a door prize?
I do.
Finally, we have a door prize.
Oh, you guys have been missing one? Missing them?
We have been.
Oh, you know what? I'll do two. How about that?
Okay, quickly.
All right, $25 to the Capital... $25 from the Capital City Council of the Blind. And the name for that is... Michael McKillop.
Is Michael in the room?
Ooh, not here. Okay.
Oh.
All right. How about Zachary Abernathy? I think he's an exhibit, so. All right, keeping going here. Debbie Clark?
Debbie's here. Debbie's here. All right.
Could I get someone up here to run this to Debbie? And Debbie, can you raise your hand so that... but first, I actually need someone up here. I really do. Okay. And then the second one is that we're going to give another $25 away. So, and I really do need someone up here, please. Thank you. We have Randy Tedrow.
Is Randy in the room?
Okay, nope.
No.
All right, Vivian Conger.
I bet she's in exhibits.
All right. Okay, Janice Squires. Yeah,
Janice
baby.
Is here.
Okay, can you give this to
Debbie? Janice? Debbie, can you?
Then Debbie, my wave, table
wave,
is up.
Wave.
To...
Yeah. All right.
Let me know when you have your door prizes, please.
And who was our wonderful mic runner this afternoon?
Somebody.
Who was running our mic during the radio presentation?
Well, I will run it if you tell me where it is.
Was it
no,
Arnie?
No, I said who was running it?
It was me.
Who's me?
Terry.
Terry.
Oh, all right. Thank you, Terry. First timer, he did an awesome job. See what you get. See what you get roped into when you come as a first timer. No, we don't want that to scare anybody away. All right, we will break now for 15 minutes. Please be back promptly at 3:30 for the next segment.
Yes. I don't have a I don't remember. It's Thank you. Okay, let's see. Doo-doo-doo. Julie Harlow. All right, I'm fast with these names here, so let's see. Beverly Saunders. All right, Beverly. And if someone could come to this table to grab this and bring it back to Beverly, who will raise her hand, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mika. My name is Steve Fixdall. I am the Secretary of the Washington Council of the Blind, and it's my pleasure to host this last segment of the day. And I don't know whether they saved the best for last or they figured we'll get Steve to do the afternoon because everybody will be asleep. It's my pleasure to introduce Mitchell Matthews of Uber, and I was just telling him I had an opportunity for the first time to use Uber in Dallas, Texas, while I was there for the American Council of the Blind convention. I went to dinner with someone, and he called the taxi, and we took the taxi to the restaurant, and it was $20. And then I remembered as we were leaving the restaurant, I had Uber because I had just downloaded it to the phone. So I said, let me call Uber. We can take them back. So we did. We got back to the hotel, and my guest asked, well, how much was that? I says, well, you spent $20. I spent $6. He didn't talk to me for several hours after that. So it is my pleasure to welcome Mitchell Matthews.
Hi, everyone. I had a little jump start there, so now I guess it's my turn to be on. So on the show of hands, I asked in the room who had used Uber in the past. And I think I saw about 10 hands, but we had some new additions. So I think maybe we're about 15, and there's probably close to 60 people in the room, I think, maybe 70. 25%. Yeah. So we have about quarter to 25% of the individuals in the room have used Uber. So Uber is a app-based technology. It is used to connect you with a ride, and those rides range on a number of different platforms. So we have vehicles which are normally associated with like an airport sedan, which would be leather interior, black car. And they would be, and that's our black car platform, and they would be at a certain price point. And then we have our XL vehicles, which are larger and fit more people, and our P2P UberX, and P2P means peer-to-peer. And those are just four-door sedans, and those sedans themselves, it's the lowest price point, and they are pretty much everywhere you could imagine in the Seattle metro area. You could name a neighborhood, and I could tell you they'd be there on that. So in Seattle, we run Uber from all the way from Tacoma and the South Sound area, and hopefully all the way up to the Bellingham community, which would be great too. So you could almost seamlessly take a ride from SeaTac Airport to anywhere in Western Washington, which would be great. There's some regulations that the municipal governments have imposed on us. So you might not be able to be picked up in some of those more remote areas, but you could definitely be dropped off. So that's kind of, you can get there, but you might not be able to get back. So one of the things that Uber has specifically in some markets, we've got Wave, which is an assistance vehicle, which we don't necessarily have in the Seattle market. There's a number of third parties, and we pay a fee associated to the city, and the city manages it and disperses the fee on that side. But what we do have is anybody that is able and accessible to get into one of our peer-to-peer or sedan vehicles or SUVs or any type of suburban or anything else, we do have the ability for them to ride with Uber. Well, wheelchair accessible? So we don't have wheelchair accessible vehicles on our platform in Seattle, but we do pay into the Seattle Wave, which is a organization within the Seattle government, I believe King County government, and we pay a per trip fee into that. So everybody that takes an Uber, regardless of if they're in a wheelchair or out of it, contributes to greater accessibility across the Seattle metro area. And so specifically in this room, we do have some people in wheelchairs and we have some people out of them on that side. And everybody here kind of has a consistent reason why they're at this conference. And one of those reasons is people here may have service animals. And so under the law, which I'm sure all you are much more up to speed than I am on ADA law, service animals are animals that are allowed in Uber vehicles. Now, the next show of hands I would like to see is how many people have here been denied service in an Uber because they've had a service animal? Okay, perfect. We had about 5 people raise their hand. And so we had about 15 people who had used Uber in the past. So about 1/3 of everybody who has used Uber in this room has also been denied the use of an Uber by one of the partners because they've had a service animal. Now, we realize that this is a bit of a systemic issue with our driver partners. And now the way Uber is organized is that the technology, which is the app, links you to a driver. And that driver is an independent business owner. But that independent business owner is still governed by ADA law and laws within Washington State or the United States that protect your right to have access to that vehicle with your service animal. Now, that 1/3 statistic, which we just have in this room, is a pretty bad statistic on our behalf, and I'll be readily admitting that as the senior driver of operations. Now, one of the things that we're endeavoring to do is improve on that statistic and make sure that Uber is accessible and does have accessibility, and that our refusals from our driver partners do go down to zero. That would be my optimal goal, and I think that would be something in the room that everybody else would prefer as well, that they don't request an Uber and then they're told no. And I think nobody wants that in any part of their life, especially when it comes to mobility and transport. So in those situations, if I might ask, one of the people who have been denied, did they ever tell you a reason why you were denied? Yes. I heard a couple of yeses and somebody was close to a mic, so I'll use that one.
Yes. So yes, the denial was, I don't take dogs. And so then I say, well, you know, this is a service dog. And this is a guide dog. I don't take dogs. I don't want to. And so I won't. Mm-hmm.
Same thing over here.
Okay.
These ladies have the same experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's rejection.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Being
allowed to go into that car.
Mm-hmm.
That's their job.
Yeah.
Then do it.
No, I agree. And so people on the Uber app are not fully employed by Uber. They're their own businesses. Some of them have their own professional jobs outside of it, and they're using their personal vehicle to do this transport. So one of the issues that we face, which you've said, is that somebody refused to have the dog come in the car as a service animal in the vehicle. Now, when they're on the Uber app, they're operating under our service and our terms and service agreement, and our terms and service agreement are bound by all the other laws that everybody else operates in, and they should be able to do that anyways if it's a for-profit venture, which they are. So in that case, the driver was wrong, and so you should all know that you should not be refused, and you all probably already know that. I got a bunch of nods in here. Yes. So yes, exactly. You should not be denied, and it's unfortunate. We don't have visibility fully into everybody that gets denied. And it's one thing that I would particularly ask of you is that when you are denied, that you notify our support group, which is our support@uber.com. And I think some people within the room also have our access to our general manager within the market where they can provide that information. And that gives us an idea because those partners are then spoken to and we have a conversation with them about what is their right and what isn't their right. And ADA allows you to have your right exercised at that point. So I know that it's on us, it's something that we want to work on and we want to improve and we want to make better. But on our side, we need that visibility from your community and we really do appreciate your voice telling us that we can do better because it is something as the senior manager of operations for Washington State, it is my job to make sure that your experience is better on our platform and to do better. Now I got 3 hands in the room. The gentleman in the back.
We have a mic runner.
Yes, you.
We need a mic.
I can reiterate what it is.
I had a comment about what you have been talking about. Basically, I was denied twice in 1 week in recent weeks. And it actually gives you a complex after a while with my dog. And I will say that Uber was extremely responsive. You can file your complaint or notification right inside the app. You don't have to wait till you can get to an email. You can be sitting in the car that actually gives you the ride and write up the complaint about the other one. So there are a couple of things that that in my particular situation, in both cases, people tried the allergy thing. Oh, I have allergies. And I said, well, so do I, but I still have rights. And so that was a piece of that. And I said to them both, you know that I'll have to notify Uber. I'll have to file a complaint. And they said, go ahead. And I thought, wow, this is pretty blatant and amazing, actually. And so I was concerned about the training from that standpoint. But I guess what I will say is that Uber was very responsive and very quick. And in one of the cases, they told me that they were going to be blocking that driver from being on my, you know, being able to pick me up again, which means I wouldn't have that experience with that driver again. But I guess my concern is that at my travel rate, if I knock off a couple a week, I won't have many Uber options left in a few weeks. So I am a little bit concerned about sort of the whole process of education and how this all occurs, because I went months and months and months with dogs and without dogs, not having any problem. And then all of a sudden, the problems have cropped up kind of twofold, one day and then the following day.
Training. Because even though, do you feel a responsibility to train all of your partners even though they're not considered employees?
Okay, we need mics, please.
I'm right here if you want to ask a question again.
Yeah. Do you consider your responsibility to train your partners, even though they're not full employees, is it your responsibility to train them in the law, or not, or do you think that someone else's?
I didn't get your name, sorry.
Dawn.
So I believe Devin in the back was the first individual, and then Dawn here just asked about the training, and both of them kind of centered back onto that training, if I'm correct on that statement. So yes, we do have an obligation to train them as part of how we're regulated, and we do take it upon ourselves to ensure that they know what the law is. So when we onboard our employees, we have an Uber one-on-one training program, which our employees in the Uber office have developed that are responsive to the laws that we operate under. So a driver partner will come into the organization and we'll go through our onboarding flow. And as part of that, they'll have an opportunity to experience the Uber one-on-one training. And the one-on-one training does include what is the law, how does the law work. We're actually looking to continue to build on that. And we're now testing welcome packages. And in those welcome packages, we're looking to specifically call out ADA requirements within there. Because remember, as the beginning of this, 15 people have taken Uber rides or have used Uber. Five of them have been denied. So the one-on-one 101 training maybe is working for two-thirds of those, but there still is that one-third of actors that we're still getting bad experience that Deb has experienced in that context. So we're still looking to improve on our own training systems and our own training programs. And one of the things as Uber as well is, I'm not sure if anybody else has been denied in any other platform of transportation. There's probably multiple. Uber's 2 years old, and hopefully we're being proactive in our situation to move the statistic and move the needle down to the point where we don't have any denials within that. Now, I have a number of hands up, but Danette in the front here, who I'm right beside, has got a question.
Okay. For me, this was only my second time on taking Uber. The first time was perfect. The second time, I wanted to go back home. For some reason, I want to go home. And I waited 3 hours. Twice I got a message on my phone saying your driver had to turn around. But I waited 3 hours, and finally Uber never showed up, and I called my friend. But they were good. I emailed them afterwards, right, when I got home, and their response was really good, and they said they were going to look into it. I don't know what happened after that, and I don't know if because of Velma was the reason why they denied it, because I don't know if they pulled up or and decided, oh, there's a dog. I ain't doing that one. I don't know that. So.
You're right. So we are generally pretty responsive, and we hope to be better and more proactively responsive. on responding when something happens where you are having a denial. And there was a note about allergies, and I think Devitt asked that one, which was if a driver denies you based on a requirement for an allergy, and some people do have allergies, some people might hide behind that excuse, they're actually obligated to wait with you until another Uber arrives at that point. And so we need to, on our side as well, educate them on that aspect as well. And that's our expectation of that partner who has that service agreement with us, that they do, in fact, do that. I got a question in the back, and I'm going to come right back to you here in a moment.
Right here. So I'm glad that you guys are educating them, but what is the follow-through? So if an Uber driver refuses someone, what's the consequence for them? Because I get a lot of that. We will call them. So what? They get, oh, no, you bad. No. What happened?
Yeah, you're right, and definitely. And you guys can laugh at us on that one because that is very true, is what happens behind the scenes. So I come from an organization and an industry prior to when being at Uber where compliance to regulations and compliance to the business is a zero-sum game in that context, that compliance is paramount. And Uber is still in the evolution of what that compliance looks like. Sorry, I got a little accent in there. I'm Canadian, so I dipped into Boudin, but... what it looks like. And for us and for me in my city and in my region, I operate on a strike rule and I make it very well known. Like that's a strike. You should not do that. You cannot do that. And they are made aware. And then it's up to us to continue to enforce that. On the flip side, we still require you to surface that to us with that partner on your account so we can track that individual. And if it's a systemic issue with that individual, then we will remove that individual from operating with our platform. Now, that doesn't mean they go away. They may use a different TNC platform like Lyft or a Flywheel. But for us, they're off. And for me, they're off because they're providing a disservice not only to your community, but to their peers in the Uber community who do pick up and who do provide a great service and who do treat you with the dignity you require and the dignity you deserve on that aspect. And I got Stuart here.
I've had a problem. It must be a problem between my phone and your app. I'm using an iPhone, I guess a 5S, and there is a place on your app where you can hit to get other options, like I think split the fare and call the driver and so forth. Right now, and I'll show this to you afterwards, maybe you want to. Last time I tried, when I hit that app, the screen never switches to what is supposed to be there. It just stays on the main screen. What that means is I can't call the driver. Now, it's generally I call the driver because I want to say, okay, I'm in front of the Starbucks here. I'm a blind guy, and you need to let me know when you arrive. You need to look for me because I can't look for you. So, and that works quite well. But because right now I don't have any way of communicating with the driver, I have switched over to Lyft because on Lyft, it's working, and the last time I checked on Uber, it wasn't working.
I heard a couple concurrences that it's not working. I think comes and goes. Okay. So I can surface that today directly to the appropriate channels in our engineering group. Seattle's got a pretty robust engineering group within our market. So I can definitely spot check that with you guys today. So afterwards, I'll wander around and kind of scurry around to whoever else is having that issue and see if I can help you with it. If not, I'll surface it up and hopefully they'll make a fix on that one. Because I don't want you to go over to Lyft, Stuart. I want you to stay with Uber. I want you to stay with me.
Perfect.
Yeah.
For people who don't have iPhone, how do you use their services? Because I just have a cell phone still.
So you can use the computer to dispatch an Uber from point A to point B, but unless you have your computer with you for portability, you can't get the ride back. So you can use it as a initial tool, but you can't use it on the way back. The platform is based off of your smartphone or a computer operating system. We do not. The app is actually the dispatcher. Somebody in the back had asked if Uber has dispatchers, but the app does the dispatching and connection for individuals, so we don't have a physical dispatcher. I got a lot of hands in the air, though. So what I'm going to do is I'm in the far left side, your far right, and I'm going to move into the center and then to the very far left of the building. So if you want to put your hands down, and I'll tell you when I get to the row, then you can have a little rest so you don't get a tired arm.
All right, Mitchell, we have 5 minutes.
Here, I got a question from Rhonda here.
Different tact. Had my first Uber experience last night with friends at this convention, one of whom had a guide dog. The driver specifically told us that we could not be denied for having a dog. So someone had been trained. But my other question is, what's my guarantee that I'm not riding with a wacko? What kind of background checks do you do on your people?
That is a good question. Very good question. So we have a very robust background check process. We check against motor vehicle records. We check against registries. We check against everything else. And we go back 7 years on that one to make sure. We also have very robust insurance provisions that protect you as a rider while you're underway and somebody else is driving the vehicle. So that does exist as well. So we do make sure that we have good people on the platform. One of the great things about Uber, though, is it's a gateway. It's if you're a driver, it's very non-discriminatory. It's agnostic to sex, race, religion, sexuality, and in some cases, disability. We have a Project Beethoven for hearing impaired individuals where the app is specifically set up to allow hearing impaired individuals to be employed or be small business owners and use the app. So I'm in the middle row here. I'm going to run back to the middle row. I got a far left one here. He's got a lollipop.
I wonder when Uber is coming to the Tri-Cities.
I would love to be in the Tri-Cities. We just have to talk to the Tri-Cities government and let them and ask them. And I imagine this is the scenario we have with that, and we're dealing with right now in Olympia, is if you're out with your friends and you're hungry and you have four friends, one of us is Uber, three of them are city mayors, and you ask them where they want to go to dinner, and they're all going to give you three different answers. So it's us too. It's like, we would like to be in your city, and all of them have different ideas of how they want us there and when they want us there and what they want us to do. So we're working our way east. We are in Spokane, though, so that's good. Yeah. We have a question in the back.
So my question is that if I have a new guide dog and I've never done this before, how can you educate me to be able to understand what to do in case they do deny me? What should I be thinking about? Yeah.
So that is a very good question. And I actually don't have a strong answer for that, but I would have an ask of you guys in the room and your community is that you're a very strong community, very tight-knit community, and I would hope that you would mentor your friends through the process of using Uber, because our platform isn't the easiest one to navigate through voice command, and it's very buggy, as we've been told. But it would be great if you would act as advocates and champions for your peers to help them through the process. Because the more of you that use Uber app, the more we're going to find out which drivers are not accepting you and allowing your service dogs in. And it's going to give me a better ability to enforce on those so I can move that one-third statistic to zero. Mm-hmm. All right, I got a question in the middle and the back.
Hello, this is Haley Edick. We've taken Uber, and my husband had to write them quite a long email, only because we had a dog, a stroller, a baby in a car seat, and two adults. So that's quite a menagerie, and we needed the right size vehicle. And my question is it required that we let Uber drivers know that we have a service animal, and can they decide, oh, I'm allergic, so I'm going to pass up this trip and pass it on to someone else?
It is not a requirement for you to notify them that you have a service dog. And it is not a requirement of them to say they have an allergy either. You don't have to notify them, or you can notify them. That's your discretion and how you want to choose to use the app. And ultimately, it's their discretion If it is a non-service dog, if it's a comfort dog, then they are allowed to deny service. But if it's a service dog, they cannot deny service. And at that point, we would ask you to report them. And on the note about your husband, the kids, the dog, the car seats, use XL. Or those are the big vehicles, big Suburbans. So you might be a bit more comfortable next time. Okay. Yeah, we got that option here. So it's a good thing you moved up. I got the middle back.
Mitchell, we're out of time.
Oh, yeah, I want to give you that. Okay. I just want to say that I've had really great experiences with Uber, and I know that it's important for us to let Uber know all of the things that they can improve on, but I've taken Uber in Washington, D.C., in the Bay Area, Denver, Seattle, and I think it's the best thing since sliced bread.
Well, thank you. There were a number of hands I couldn't get to, but I'll hang around to your next break, which I think is in a half hour.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I'll hang around for the half hour, and I'll just give you guys a heads up that I'll be over on a table, and you can come over and ask questions there if you'd like.
Fantastic.
Sound good?
Perfect. Thank you very much. All right, next on the agenda, it is a pleasure to introduce Deb Lewis. I have the privilege of working with her on the SRC and get to see her in the role that she plays for us in advising the State Rehabilitation Council, but as mentioned earlier, she does wear other hats, and one of those hats is as working with the Center on Technology and Disability Studies at the University of Washington. So, Debbie, the floor is yours.
I'm actually going to be very judicious of our time because I know everybody wants to do all kinds of other stuff. So this presentation will be a little bit shorter because it's gotten started a little bit later. I wanted to make just a couple of comments that would segue us to technology. First of all, my first comment is that I really want to invite any of you to participate in our technology forum that we have once a month on the second Tuesday of the month at 7 p.m. And we use technology that I think most of you are familiar with. We use the telephone. I think most of you, if any of you don't know how to use that technology, you can kind of get with one of the people in your chapter, and I'm sure they'll give you a basic orientation. Or check with Sue Amateur. She's a really good phone user. Now, seriously, we do definitely use that medium, although we would welcome other types of media for you to try to connect with us for the forum calls. Mika did such a wonderful job of managing the forum calls for several years, and I am having a really tough time living up to that. But what I... what we have been really trying to do is address your real technology interests and needs. So, for example, if there are a bunch of you who are really nervous about the Uber app, we could have a training in the technology forum on how to use the Uber app. And we could even have one on how to use the Lyft app, if that's what you want to do. It's not that much different, but I know sometimes people really want to know. And I've had lots of people come up to me and say, oh, you know, I really want to use those kinds of apps. They make a lot of sense to me. But boy, I'm really nervous. And I'm like, you mean like, what if you actually get a car? Well, yeah, then what do I do? Well, you get in, you know. It pretty much works. And even though some of us have talked about some of our frustrations and challenges with it, I've taken hundreds of Uber rides. I have three where there were problems, one of which had nothing to do with the guide dog. So, you know, it's when you really add up the averages. And even though I'll say, like with Uber and Lyft and those kinds of things, even if they aren't in your city, most of you don't spend all of your time in your city. So I'd get myself signed up for a few of these and use them where it makes sense, because you never know when you'll be stranded. And I am a tester to the fact that you can take Uber anywhere, and sometimes you can't take it back. And so I actually know that story, too. Fortunately, I suspected it before I ever took off, so I made another arrangement. But on the forum calls, we really do talk about very, very practical things most of the time, and we talk about people's real questions and real technology challenges. And sometimes we do have a topic, but I will tell you those topics are a little bit loosely configured. We sometimes talk about the topic the whole time. We sometimes talk about the topic 30 seconds, and then we move right into what people actually do want to talk about. So if there is something that you'd like for us to talk about in the technology forum, it doesn't mean that I necessarily know anything about it, but I'll try to find somebody who does, and we will try to give you some pointers and some help about that in that. And what I usually find out is that whatever you would like to know, somebody else would like to know, and they just haven't asked us. So it really isn't that your question is sort of weird or dumb or whatever. One of the things that we've been kind of coming to a conclusion about, and it's great following the Uber presentation for this reason too, because one of my themes is, like it or not, kicking and screaming or not, the smartphone age is here to stay. Yeah. And that could be good, that could be bad, right? And so it is here to stay. And what that means is that we need to be thinking about how to help people move into that particular technology range. And some of you start your questions with, I don't have one of these. And I get that. I get that sometimes we don't have them for economic reasons. Sometimes we don't have them for other reasons. But what I wanted to talk about a little bit today was sort of all of the range of things that people can do with their phone. And I hope I hit on something that you actually haven't done yet, even if you're a good smartphone user, because my point is we haven't tapped it all. What's going to happen in the next 5 years or so is that the phone is simply going to be a very inexpensive, and really, believe me, overall, a very inexpensive way to facilitate a technology platform for all kinds of other technologies. We're seeing that now. How many of you have some kind of Bluetooth device other than a keyboard or braille display that you are connecting, and speakers, that you are connecting to your iDevice to do something? Yeah, what? What? Okay, a note taker would be a braille display. So what I'm talking about, like practical household devices. Does anyone have their alarm system connected to their iPhone?
My refrigerator.
Your refrigerator is connected to your iPhone?
Wow.
What does it do? Oh, it will be. It may be. And we could have an inventory app that could actually check in your refrigerator to see if you're out of beer, right? That might work. That might work. Yeah. Okay. So an alarm system is something that is now very, very commonly connected via a smartphone. So the alarm system might or might not be accessible without that smartphone, but with that smartphone, it has the potential to be accessible. Anybody have their coffee pot connected to their iPhone? Not yet. Well, it's possible. You can. It exists. So you could, I don't think most of us have a very good way of setting those automatic timers on our coffee pods so that the coffee really will brew at 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning when we wish we could get up. But I'm still working, you can tell. So, yeah, there you go. The Starbucks app, right. But it doesn't brew it and it doesn't bring it to you. It just pays for it out of your account. That's not a very good app. But anyway, basically, though, but a good example about the Starbucks app is, I used to carry all those little Starbucks cards in my purse. I never had any idea how much was left on any of them, but I had 40 of them probably, just shuffle them and take a few in, hand a handful over, say, I hope I can get a cup of coffee out of all this. But once you plug all those into your app, then you know exactly that you're broke. or that you have just 10 cents shy of a latte. You start to think, which of those things that I don't believe in for earning money activities are good now? So certainly, you know, alarm systems, the coffee pot. How many of you are using GPS on your iPhone? We'll get a few for that. Yeah, I thought we'd get a few for that. Yeah, exactly. How many of you are using and GPS devices without a device like the iPhone or a device like a Braille note or a Braille sense or something? Those devices are pretty expensive just out on their own, right? And pretty inaccessible. You've been in anybody's car lately, and have you managed their Garmin lately? Not likely. Yeah. Yeah, sighted people can't do it either. Yeah, in fact, I have a number of coworkers who prefer to have me ride with them so I can take care of that GPSing thing. And of course, I think I mentioned at a technology forum we had a couple years ago, somebody said, what in the world would a blind person do with GPS? And my coworker said, if I was blind, I wouldn't be moving one inch without it. So she said, I've seen the way people drive and go and where they go and all that kind of thing. And anyway, that's another thing, though, that obviously, any of you doing OCR on your iPhone? Yeah, several of you. Now, those are expensive if you have to go out and buy those puppies by themselves, right, the OCR things. So yes, and so you get all this in your one little device. And anybody tracking, anybody, let's see, I know Marlena does, but anybody besides me have an Apple Watch yet? All right. Okay, so let me tell you about the activities or the other device that would be in a similar category, at least in terms of what I'm about to talk about, would be a Fitbit. Somebody have a Fitbit out there? Oh, I'm surprised. I see lots of you. Oh, no. So the Fitbit is great, too. The Apple Watch has some different functions, but the Fitbit would be the cheaper way to start. There are a couple of accessibility Googles about the Fitbit, but basically you can make that work, and we can then track our physical activity. Now, I know that for some of us, that's 0, 0, 0. I'm sorry you had negative activity today. Your heart didn't even beat. Oh, whoa, yeah. So there's that problem. But if you are using your Apple Watch to track your physical activity, you can find out that, and you can compare it to yourself. And you can use the health app to track your weight, and you can connect your Apple Watch and the health app to a whole variety of apps that will monitor your every waking and thinking moment, if that's what you want to do. Now, the thinking moments maybe not so much, but the waking moments, that's pretty useful, because especially if you're tracking any kind of a health thing, you can do that. And I absolutely recommend MyFitnessPal as one of the more accessible apps to do that with, although they and I have a war about some things with their iPhone app. But it's not about accessibility. It's about the fact that it sometimes wants to enter things twice. And I'd love to get double credit for my exercise, but it makes me kind of mad when it double credits the dessert I snuck in. Oh, you just ate two of those. No, I didn't. Exactly. All right, some other things that we've been doing. Let's get a little serious about this. Any of you have a blood pressure device that you use in connection with a blood pressure monitor? Okay. And there are several brands of those that are available that will work with a smartphone that would otherwise not be accessible. Anybody using a weight scale for either food or yourself or other family members who need to, not for us, right? Yeah. Seriously, a weight scale of some kind with their iPhone. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And there are several of those on the market that have fairly good accessibility. Usually, you do need some sighted assistance to set those up because there's some kind of non-accessible sorts of things to track at the very beginning of it. But once you get it set up, you should be able to use it the rest of the time. And those have come a long way. So, and they're very buyable at places like Amazon and of course the Apple Store and such as well. Let me see. Heart rate monitors. Anybody using a heart rate monitor other than like the Apple Watch, but just a standard Bluetooth heart rate monitor? Okay. The heart rate app isn't necessarily very accurate, but if you want to actually get a heart rate monitor, you can get those that will be accessible. Mm-hmm.
It's not the heart rate app. It measures my pulse.
Okay. Yes. So measuring pulse. Uh-huh. You can do that. Thermometer. Either for the meat in the oven or the temperature thermometer for measuring the temperature of you, like when you're getting hot and mad. Anybody using thermometers with their iPhone? Okay. You might want to think about that. You know, there's certain temperatures we're supposed to be getting meat to, and I know sometimes maybe we're not. So a good meat thermometer that works with your eye device is great as well. Yeah. So my point is, there's a few hundred things out there right now that you can be doing, and these are growing exponentially and daily. And so they basically require some type of eye device. Now, many of them work with devices that are Apple eye devices that aren't necessarily a phone. So sometimes you've asked, well, can I do these things on an iPad or an iPod or such? And the answer is it depends on the device. Specifically, apps that require interaction with GPS are going to work best with the iPhone because it has GPS built in. In other words, you have to add another appendage, a GPS device, to your other devices to make that work. So typically that's going to be how that goes. But if you don't require GPS for the functionality that you have, then you may also be able to do this on another kind of device. So those are just a few of the things that I think make this a really important venture for people if we're moving forward and as we're trying to solve the tech problems. Oh, yeah, and one of the big ones that I know a bunch of you do, even though you can get a very nice player from the library, some of you are using the NLS Bard app on your iPhone, right? Yeah. And I don't really use this app too much myself personally. It's just more of a lifestyle thing than objecting to the app. But Rick thinks that it actually has the best algorithm for speeding up, you know, like when you want to speed, that it has a better algorithm for doing that than the player does. And so if you do like your books fast, and you do have an eye device, you may want to try that particular way of getting at that. So that's just a thought about that. So those are some of the kinds of things that we do talk about on the...
What about diabetic things?
So far I haven't actually seen... Frank asked about diabetic things. So far I haven't actually seen an insulin gauge, but I know that that's actually being worked on. I know there's some testing going on for that. I know there are a number of medical facilities that are testing some apps that they will use in conjunction with some devices that would be like a Fitbit or an Apple Watch, but that are built, that are being dedicated to monitor particular medical conditions. And there's a lot of work being done on that. And Apple has actually invested a lot of money in that, around the use of the health app. So they're very much pushing the application of that in various medical settings. So that's really great. And then, of course, some of you do have things like Braille displays connected and keyboards and all those useful things that just make using those things, those apps and particular devices a lot easier too. So that's one area that we do talk about really pretty often as new technologies that relate to the smartphones in the forum. And any questions about that before we move on to talking about some other kinds of things?
Yeah.
Well, microphone. Wait a minute, microphone.
I have a question. Is there a way that you can get the iPhone to transmit to hearing aids?
Yes. Depends on your type of hearing aids. But there are hearing aids that are iPhone compatible, yes. And some people who use them do not like them. Some people actually prefer to still go ahead and connect rather than having a wireless connection between the iPhone directly and the hearing aid. Some people feel that there's a little background sound. Well, there is a sound. It's whether that sound bothers you or not. It bothers, I know Rick and I've had this discussion, that sound bothers him more than it bothers me. It drives him nuts. So if he had hearing aids, he wouldn't be able to do it. But I probably could because I'm sort of oblivious to background noise. So basically it just depends a little bit on you, but it's mostly dependent on the type of hearing aid. So checking with your hearing aid provider about whether yours are or can be made compatible is certainly one route. Mm-hmm.
Wondering about how to connect with that technology forum the second Tuesday of the month.
We always send out a reminder on the WCB listserv, and it includes the phone number there, which I haven't memorized. Probably somebody does actually know it by heart.
800-977-8002.
Hold on. 800-977-8002. And the code is 5419226. I dial it every month, but you can tell I have no idea because I have this in my phone and it just goes do 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 do, you know, and shows up for me. So, I totally believe in contacts. I believe everybody. Yes, Cindy.
Wait a minute, Cindy.
We'll get this one for the mic.
Debbie, ACB. Came out with an app.
Yes.
And it really looks awesome, actually. ACB Link, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But one of the things that I haven't been able to figure out how to do is I thought I would be able to listen to ACB radio on it.
You can.
But the only thing when I hit the tab that says radio, the only option I find is it wants to play that recording on telling me how to use the app, which I don't want to listen to.
I didn't bring my phone up here. Oh, yes, I did. No, I didn't. I didn't bring my
it's
phone.
It's a great app, though, yeah. And I want to just say if you can get, yeah. I mean, anybody, if you have an iPhone, download the ACB Link app, and it's really cool. You can look for the nearest affiliate, and when you, if you let it, it'll say, like, find my location or something like that.
Right.
It will actually put you into WCB since you're in Washington.
Right, right.
And then you can link to our website.
Right.
And it's very easy to navigate. So I'm so impressed with it. It's a great way to get to WCB's website through the app.
And because I don't have my phone up here, I can't actually tell you quickly, and maybe I couldn't tell you quickly anyway because it would take me a second to figure it out again, how to get to the streams. But I've been listening to our live feed on it. And so what I will do is I will post to the WCB list, and we will mention on the next forum call, which is Tuesday the 10th, we will mention on the forum call, and we can demonstrate it there, and we will post. I will post to the list exactly how to get to all of the streams, because all of the streams are there. And I was thrown by that same thing. I went to radio on the tab, and then it didn't work. But there's actually a link in there that takes you to the streams. And so the tutorial is actually physically present all the time, and that's why it looks like all you can do on that page is do the
tutorial. That we should be able to hide the tutorial.
Okay, Jeff Bishop might be listening, and he's the primary developer. Jeff, they'd like to hide the tutorial. Okay. We'll make sure that they get that feedback. It is a really, really nice app, though. And of course, you know, there are lots of ways to listen to ACB radio, and we have people listening on all kinds of devices. You can listen to it on your Victor Reader stream. I hope you have speakers, though, because it sure sounds rotten if you don't. And you can listen on your iPhone with the ACB app or with Utunes, and you can listen on iBlink Radio, and you can just listen on all kinds of places. Yes, on the telephone, you can dial a phone number and listen. And I just wanted to mention, because I didn't get a chance to make this comment when Larry Albert was here talking, but ACB Radio has a wonderful old-time radio feed called The Treasure Trove, and that is available in all the places that you can get any of the ACB streams. And if you do like old-time radio, it's very thoughtfully and carefully done and high quality. And it's actually one of the few, if maybe only, old-time radio stream that actually feeds at 128K because people think with spoken language they can feed it at a really low bit rate and you won't care. But people do care, and it sounds so much better. So that is an excellent resource for that for you. But, yeah, I will post how to get to the streams because it took me about 10 minutes going, rrr, rrr, rrr. And I kept going, you know, I know they want me to read this tutorial, but I'm not going to do it. And so so I have to admit I was pretty stubborn, but we did get there. And so that was great. But it's a super app. And lots of great material. And I did get to our convention page, showed with the live stream page, and showed all of our agenda. And yeah, it's just all very, very nicely done. Really nicely done. We'll so tell Jeff you all want to hide the tutorial. All right. But maybe you better read it because I had trouble. Okay. Yes. Was there another question?
This is Betty, and yes. I have a question. So when you want to get the app, the uh-huh. ACB app.
Yes.
So do you just do what you do? You know, you go to get, and then you say what you want to have. Like, do you just say ACB Radio?
No. Oh. When you want to download it and get it on your phone?
If I want the app on the phone, yes.
Yeah. So I actually just searched for ACB, and it was the second item in the result of that search. So there were several results up there, but it's the second one I got by just doing ACB. Wait,
so you mean when you go, you have to go to search?
Store. We need to go to the App Store.
Yeah, or you go to the App Store, yes. And then you go search.
And then you just type in ACB.
Okay, yeah.
And press search.
Yep.
And then you're going to get a list of apps that have ACB, the letters, in a row in them.
Okay.
And it's the second one. It'll be very obvious.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, it's ACB Link, and it'll be the second result you get in that list.
All right, thank you.
If you really want to type in all ACB Radio, then yeah, it'll probably be the one of the quickest links, but it's really not ACB Radio. It's ACB Link, so you'd have to write that. But ACB is the best way to search for it in the App Store. And it's a free app, of course. So you'll just hit get, and then you'll hit install. Yeah. Yeah, it's very doable. And if anybody's got their phone here this weekend and they want us to help, many of us would be glad to help you get it downloaded onto your phone. That's the easy part. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions or comments about this stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember a couple of years ago you had said in one of the SRC meetings that mm-hmm. you'd gotten to the point that you pretty much only use your phone, and I thought I was just amazed with that. Well, I found over the summer mm-hmm. I almost forgot to use JAWS because I use my phone so much, and it's so much easier. PDF files, uh-huh. It goes straight to my KNFB reader or uh-huh. something else, menus that I can read, and I've also gotten rid of carrying color identifiers and a CCTV right. and all the apps, and money so your comment about saving money is just, I can't second that enough because sure. it the devices that you get down, it's just such a buy, and I always suggest, too, if money is an issue, that you can buy several versions down, like a 5 mm-hmm. or a 5S for like $49 now, and yeah. it's yeah. really good buys.
I would recommend that if you would like to buy a used phone, that you not purchase below a 5S right now, because we're running to the end of the life cycle of the 5. So I recommend that the 5S is still perfectly good, and you'll find lots of them around. And I know because at our house we have a 5S, we have a 6, and we have a 6S Plus. And I can tell you that the 5S definitely holds its own for almost every activity you'd want to do.
This is Stuart Russell.
Stuart.
I'm about to purchase an iPhone. I'm on the T-Mobile program where after a few months you get a discount.
Uh-huh.
So it'll be 6S or 6S Plus. Uh-huh. And because I'm visually impaired, the larger screen on the Plus wouldn't do me any good.
That's true.
Is there any reason why I might want the 6S Plus over the 6S?
Well, you know, that's going to be a very individual, situation. I do have a 6 and a 6S Plus. So I don't have the 6S and the 6S Plus are the same size, and the 6 and the 6S. Oh, no, I didn't get that right. The 6S regular one and 6S Plus are the same size, and the 6 and the 6S, yeah, I did get that right, are the same size. So the pluses are the same size, and the regular 6s are the same size. So I have a regular 6, and I have a 6S Plus, and I can show you the size difference. Now, as far as whether you like the bigger phone or not, I happen to like it particularly for surfing the web or other kinds of things where screen layout may be of use. But one reason that you might not like it, if you have, I have very long hands too. My fingers are really long, so I can reach the top of my phone. But if you have a short hand, you know, smaller hand, then you will not be able to reach all the way to the top of your phone. What they recommend for ergonomics is that you should be able to reach, if you place the heel of your hand, the bottom of the palm of your hand, the heel of your hand at the base of your phone, your middle finger should be able to reach all the way to the top of your phone. If it cannot, your phone may be too long ergonomically for your hands to comfortably use, and you could incur some carpal tunnel. So it also, if you use your phone one-handed, see, I use the touchscreen part of my phone completely one-handed. I hold it in the same hand that I'm typing with. Now, you may not do that. I mean, I know Rick, my husband, he holds it in one hand and types with the other. He thinks that's the only way to do this. I can tell you the only convenient way when you're managing a dog and some food and several other things going on at the same time, that I've only got one hand for the phone. I mean, I need more hands if we're going to do that. So for me, I have to be able to also reach all the way across the phone. And when I got my 6S Plus, that was originally pretty uncomfortable for me. I've now kind of stretched my hand into it, and I'm okay. But for the first 2 or 3 weeks, I found it to be heavy and wide. And it was like, oh, my God, I think I screwed up this time. But I'm on that T-Mobile program, too, so I knew I could get rid of it in a few months. But I'm not going to now because I really like it. Otherwise, there's probably not necessarily any real strategic advantage for most people to have the 6S Plus.
Yes, question. Yeah. I have a question.
Yeah.
I upgraded to the software 9, whatever it is, 0.1 or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I cannot find the edit. I used to have it on the router, and I could turn and you could do edit, and then you could copy and paste. I found select text, and I can select all, but where in the world do you copy? Do you know?
Yes, there's still an edit, and you have to have the edit field available to you to get at that. Otherwise, it's not available.
It's not on the. Is it on the router?
It's on the rotor. It's on the rotor, but it's only on the rotor when an edit field
gotcha.
Is present.
Okay, thank you.
So if you open up notes, when people ask, this is a pretty common question people ask, so it's okay. Even if it wasn't common, but it is. I can't find the edit anymore. So very safe place is open notes and get a new note. And now we're guaranteed to have an edit field, and you'll find that it's available to you. We need to probably wrap up because time is just about, we can take maybe one more question if there is one more question. Otherwise, we'll see you all on the forum call.
Here you go.
I just had one comment about the difference between the 6S and the 6S Plus.
Yeah.
Is that if you're out and about a lot on an all-day basis, the 6S Plus is going to provide you longer battery life because of the physical size.
Yeah, mine actually is about the same. Mine's about the same. Not very much difference. Maybe a half hour difference, but not on a regular day-to-day basis. They're not even different. They are different than the 5S. I will tell you the 5S has less battery life, but the bigger phone isn't providing as much more battery life as some people tout. Okay, well, thank you all for staying late and having fun, and I hope you're all having a super convention, and we'll see you all on Tuesday on the forum call.
All right. Mitchell, where are you hiding?
On the left.
Over on the left? Okay.
For you.
Yeah.
All right, that wraps up this afternoon session. Mika?
Yes.
You have time for a door prize for us?
No. Yes, I do.
Oh. All right. Excused.
Man, everyone's going to come mob this table afterwards. Okay. And Carolyn Yunker, are you here? No, no. I'm asking if you're here because I'm help. I'm sorry. Oh, my gosh. Y'all know, I've been doing this practically all day. I always say the prize first. We have not deviated from plan here. Okay? I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. $25 from the Capital City Council of the Blind. Vanessa Pruitt. Lester, stop. Vanessa Pruitt, are you here? Okay, so sad. All right, let's see. Byron Kazmarski. Okay, here we go. Next, I'm ruthless here. Danielle Miller. Oh man, all right. Connie Hollis.
Oh, I'll take that.
Do we want to do another one? Do we want to do one more? All right, one more.
Go
all right,
for
I
it.
Have a. It is a fanny pack with a bottle opener or with a water bottle holder. Man, you guys let me do this long enough, and I'll be naming all kinds of stuff and a timer. Okay. It's a what? With large print numbering. So, we have. Bobby McCalden. Okay. Alicia Garcia Gijon. Okay. Good, because she is here. Okay, you guys got to say it.
All right. Thank you. Don't forget the showcase of talent tonight at 7:30. And Mitchell had agreed to stick around to answer your Uber questions. He's up here at the front podium. So feel free to continue the conversation. Otherwise, we'll see you a little later this evening. Thank you.